Turn, if you would, to Galatians, the fifth chapter. I know it seems strange that a preacher should have to say this word honestly, but honestly, if I could only have a couple of three chapters in the entire Bible, this Galatians chapter 5 would have to be one of them. I believe it honestly is one of my favorite verses or my favorite chapters in all the Bible. Several reasons for that is I believe that in this chapter, I understand finally what God's grand strategy for a believer is. Somehow, for me, I mean, other chapters tell it, but for me, the light bulb came on in this chapter. And for the first time, I understood, I think God was saying, Randy, this is what the life of a believer is. I believe that understanding. I believe my own personal experience in the chapter. And then I believe my own watching and looking at lives. And I get to celebrate out of this chapter because I've seen your lives change. And this core eternal principle in Galatians 5 is seen on a regular basis. This morning, if you're taking notes, I wish you good luck on it. Actually, there will be some things you may want to take notes on. I will agree. But if you find an outline, please turn it into me. This is a conversation today. I told Julie, she and I were talking about this. She said, what are you going to do on that chapter? We talked about the text during the week. I said, I'm going to have a conversation. I said, I'm probably not going to preach a lot of a sermon. I'm going to have a conversation. And Julie just brightened up and she said, oh, sometimes those really turn out well. She's not here today. Actually, she's not. She came down with a bad case of shingles all across the face yesterday. So she is miserable at home. But this too shall pass. The text describes something that if I can borrow, it's hard to corrupt a Monty Python movie. I'm just going to tell you. It's kind of a cult movie from the olden days. The Search for the Holy Grail, which I never saw or heard of. I want you to know that. But it has a line in there that says, bring out your dead. If I were more of an actor, I would actually do it. Miss Kara, would you come do it for them, please? It's bring out your dead. Bring out your dead. If I could sort of borrow from this, it would be bring out your deadness. Bring out your deadness. And let me give you life in its place. I realize that in the American church, when we meet together on the Sunday morning assembly, I realize we're a bit of a marketplace. It's a bit of a montage of all kinds of things. It's a bit of a hodgepodge of all kinds of things. In the American church, when it meets on Sunday mornings, and please don't hear anything disrespectful in this. I don't mean it that way. And so if I word this slobbery bad, cut me some slack. But when you gather together with the church on Sunday mornings, the American church, you got everything. You got kids who didn't want to be there, but somebody made them come, and so they're sitting there texting back and forth, and now it's their grandparents texting. Within the American church, you have somebody who is a fundamentalist in the worst kind of the word, because they're angry, and they just figured out some way to try to put their anger within religion, and so you've got that. You have liberals who gather at the marketplace, which means they have a private agenda, but it's probably not based off the heart of God. You have that. You got men, women, singles. You got every age group in between, where everything under the sun is taking place on why and how they're here. But in that menagerie of the marketplace, there's this incredible scattering. It's unpredictable. Jesus describes how the Holy Spirit works as like a wind. He uses the illustration, and he uses the illustration that those who are born again, they're like the wind. Well, it's unpredictable in this scattering, and you watch, and there is a change of deadness to life, and something happens. There is an inside turnout. can the leopard change his spots? The answer is absolutely, incredibly so. The angry fundamentalist sometimes becomes a real, live, gentle, grace-filled believer. The liberal sometimes comes back and is a grace-filled, changed individual. The kid with the text who didn't care anything, texting about anything, there's something that begins to happen and a stirring, and there's a transformation. And where did this kid that I used to have go? And where did this wonderful kid who looks like the image of God, where did this one come from? This text describes it. There's a transformation. Galatians 5, verses 22 and 23 are the core verses in it. It says in this text, "But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control." It goes through a series of descriptions about the fruit. It's a singular fruit, and I'm not trying to split hairs on this. The point is, this is not a smorgasbord where some Christians get two or three of these and others don't get some of these. And it's not that. It's just that if I would see Craig right there, and if I would have Craig stand here, by how you know Craig or what you see with Craig as you walk around his life, if he has the fruit of the Spirit, you would say, oh, I see love and joy and peace and patience and kindness. Those are just different aspects of how the fruit of God is in his life. And so they're collective. The old idea that, hey, I'm going to be more of a Christian, so this week I'm going to work on love, next week I'm going to work on joy, next week I'm going to work on peace or patience, that's not what this is about. You'll never get anywhere doing that, I assure you. He describes this as a divine touch. When God interacts and divinely touches your life, this is what you'll look like. When God says, would you like to know where I'm taking you? This is where I'm taking you. If you want to know the final result of what I'm going to do with you, this is what I'm going to do with you. Life for death. The fruit of the Spirit. We all have fruit in our life. I guess that's where I need to start. Fruit in your life is inevitable. You have fruit. It's just you can't keep it from having it. The same way that metal rusts. The same way that furniture gathers dust. The same way that a yard gets weeds. Your life has fruit. And when you walked in here today, you are a fruity individual. You might want to tinker with the wording on that a little bit, but no, you are. Because there is something in your life that marks you as the product or the fruit of your life. That's inevitable. And when Paul begins to speak to the Corinthians, he basically says, look, the fruit you're going to have that is natural and inevitable is this. Start in the 19th verse of Galatians 5. In Galatians 5, 19, he says, now the acts of the sinful nature are obvious. Sexual immorality, impurity and debauchery, idolatry and witchcraft, hatred, discord, jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition, dissensions, factions and envy, drunkenness and orgies and the like. I warn you. He goes through a list. Now, this is not a definitive list. This is not the list to end all list. But he just grabs off the palette of colors of the different kinds of fruit that are inevitable. He just throws some things out there. If you sort of look at them, they sort of kind of fall in some general categories. The fruit of your life is going to have something to do with sensual things. And your deadness will come. And your captivity will come. And your slavery will come. And your hatred lifestyle that spills over into the lives of other people, it will come out of sensual things. It will come out of worship things. It will come out of emotional things. And it will come out of addictive or escapism things. But you got fruit in your life. It is inevitable. Everybody has it. The question is, what do you do with that poison fruit? What do you do with it? If I run with just the visual metaphor of weeds in the yard kind of illustration, that they're just inevitable, there was probably a time in your life you didn't care who saw, it didn't matter to you. I mean, I went outside of school teachers or your mother or something, but I mean, you didn't care. So you put the weeds of your life were on display, and you didn't give a darn. Who cares? It's who I am. I can control it. I can manage it. It's something I like. It doesn't control me. I control it, which is a charade and a lie, but that kind of idea, and so I like it, and so it was on display. But I'm talking to a church crowd. In a church crowd, automatically, somewhere along the line, you said, you know, I really don't like all this myself, and I certainly don't like other people seeing it, so you begin to transplant it, and so you moved it to the backyard. And so it's in the backyard, so all of us driving by, we don't see it, and we don't interact with it much. Maybe even your family doesn't interact with it much. You put it in the backyard. But even there, you recognize, I don't like this. I don't like what it's doing. I don't like where it is. And so a funny thing even occurred. You started hiding it even deeper. I would have said that I have nothing in common with that local guy somewhere down three streets over and two houses down that grows marijuana. Truth is, I've spent a lot of my life like him. Because eventually you take it out of the backyard and you go hide it in a corner of the attic and you put an artificial light on it and a little watering system and you don't want anybody else to see it, or you put it down in the basement and so it's behind that plastic. And so when you shake hands with so-and-so, everybody says, hey, nice guy, good guy, really likable. But the reality is the fruit of our life, and we know it. It's there. I'd like to say it wasn't, but if you live with me close enough, you'd recognize that's the pattern of all of us. There is a natural fruit we have. I was forced to face I have three or four incidents in my life that are the most humiliating to me. If you promise not to tell anybody, I'll tell you one of them. It really is. I tell you just by way of a frame of reference to mark when it was, this particular story is, it was the year that I was president of the Missouri Christian Convention. I don't think these are unrelated issues. It's the bank. It's a simple little story. I went to the bank, and there was a series of cars in line to go through the drive-through. And there were a lot of cars and just one or two lines that were open, and we were pretty backed up. And they opened up a third line. When they opened up the third line and threw the light on it, somebody came from way back around and pulled in and just went by all the line of cars and pulled into the new open line. I saw the lady in front of me kind of throw her hands up in the air. She was in her car, and because she was getting ready to pull out and go over, and she saw that happen. I mean, you know the same deal, lines at Walmart and all those sort of things. The car that pulled in and went around us had an OCC sticker on the back. Actually, it was a KOBC sticker. It was the radio station. And immediately, I thought, that's a Bible college kid. That's a Christian who wears this sticker that I follow the Lord, and lo and behold, look what you did. And there was this sense that I would have said that it welled up on the testimony of Christ should be consistent, and I would like to say that was what, but nah, that's a lie. When that car finished their business, I pulled out. I am embarrassed. How do you do these things? Why do you do these things? I pulled out and met them, rolled my window down, and gave a tongue lashing. I mean, I didn't call names, and it wasn't a horrible tongue lashing and all those things, but I chewed a guy out. He didn't have to say anything. Somewhere in the sequence, he just nodded his head, oh, I'm sorry, and he drove off. I realized he didn't know. He just drove in, and there was an open line, and he went to it. There was a Barney Fife inside of me, a Barney Fife that I felt disrespected, and we felt disrespected, and I went to the part of my life that the fruit that he describes in here, Randy, like rust on metal, like weeds in yards, like dust on furniture, it's inevitable. It comes as a sign of your deadness, as a sign of your slavery and captivity, as a sign of an unconverted heart. Paul puts both of those side by side. You have this fruit, or you have this one. You either have life or the fruit that has death. How do you get the poison out? That's a really significant question. How do you get the poison out? I grew up in southwest Missouri and rocks and hills and brush. And I mean, there's timber rattlers that are out here and copperhead moccasin, you know, snaky whacker things. And I mean, they're bad. I mean, they're green and long and black and blue. And I mean, I don't care what its first name is. If its last name's Snake, that's plenty, you know, I mean, that sort of thing. But we grew up around poisonous snakes. They were just there. Little girl in second grade with me at a country school. There were just three of us at the time, in that second grade, and she got bit by a copperhead. I remember her being at the hospital and stuff. And so, how do you get the poison out? What do you do? Well, it's interesting what we were told, and they were all myths. They were all myths. Here were the things that we were told when I was a kid. I mean, I was taught these things. I was taught that if you got bit by a snake and you got poison in you, I'm looking down at Bob down here. Bob's our resident emergency room. I'm going to go find Bob is what my answer is now. Somebody told me last hour, Randy, you didn't tell us what the answer was. You told us the myths. The answer is find Bob. Bob, would you raise your hand if you wouldn't mind, okay? If one of those copper moccasin-headed things bites you, you find Bob. I'm just telling you that. But here's what we were told. We were told put a tourniquet on it. Be sure and throw a tourniquet. So if you got bit here, throw it around here. Well, later on they came back and said, no, don't put tourniquets on it. That's not good to do. We were told to do the John Wayne thing. You take out your Bowie knife and you cut a 6-inch, you know, a mark across both sides of this thing. You cut the arm off and then shake the poison out and put it back on. I mean, you were taught to put some huge, you know, cut on it. And so that when we were taught that, they say, no, don't be taking your razor blade and cutting the X on it, all that kind of stuff. It just does more damage. You didn't do anything on that. We were told to find a friend who would suck out the poison. Oh, that's a really good deal for the snake. He gets a 2-for-1 deal, okay? I mean, he only gets you, but he gets your friend. That's good, too. Now, actually, they say, no, having somebody suck the blood out of it or suck the blood out yourself, that isn't going to get the poison out. We were told, be sure and pack your arm in ice or your leg in ice and go to the... And they say, no, don't put it in ice. All those were myths. They don't work. So how do you stop having the fruit of a life that brings discord, where you and your wife don't get along very well? And how do you get rid of the fruit that's hid in the corner of your attic, in the corner of your basement? Galatians 5 has this incredible story. Now, Galatians 5 follows the first four chapters, so don't let me disregard anything he's already said, which has to do with broken people who come to Christ for grace and mercy. And you decide, here's my life, Lord, as broken as it is, I bring it to you. So let's make sure we keep that in there. But in Galatians 5:13, actually picks it up in verse 6 first, gets distracted, and comes back to it in Galatians 5:13, and here's what he says. Do you want the antivenom? Do you want the antivenom to the fruit that's been destroying you? Here's what it is. Galatians, let's go to verse 6. Yeah, thank you, you've got it. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision has any value. Churchiness is not going to fix this problem. The only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. Let me make this real clear. He says, I want you to know there's some myths that are out there. You won't get rid of the poison in your life by doing this myth-type things for getting rid of it. For one, let me just be real honest with you. Putting a belief in Jesus Christ as the Son of God who died for your sins and is coming back again, as powerful as that belief is, only an intellectual belief of that fact, just holding to that intellectually, it won't make the poison go away. We got churches full of snakes who state the right theology. Poison's everywhere. No, the poison won't go away by that. Being really active and churchy activities won't make it go away. You can do churchy activities forever and the poison won't go away. To borrow from Mark Buchanan, leafiness doesn't mean fruit.
You can be leafy as much as you want to, and all leafy does is disguise a little bit that there isn't any fruit. I mean, you got to kind of paw through the leaf, and there isn't any fruit there. But there's leafiness that's all kinds of places. The Western church has specialized in those two things: an intellectual belief and churchy activities. And yet, like a bunch of marijuana growers, addicts are still full of the poison. So here's what he has said in the verse we just used. The only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. Now let's go to verse 13. In Galatians 5:13, you, my brothers, were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge the sinful nature. Rather, serve one another in love. The entire law is summed up in a single command: love your neighbor as yourself. Here's what he says. You want to know what God has determined that he will do. God has determined that he himself will produce fruit in your life. God has determined that he himself will withdraw and take out the poison. God himself has determined that he himself will create this from death to life. Your life will get fruit, but here's the deal. You're going to have to follow Christ. And you're going to have to follow the leading of the Spirit. You're going to have to walk with the Spirit. You're going to have to keep in step with the Spirit. You have to please the Spirit. All those are phrases that he used in this. And every one of those he defines under this context. Follow Christ into a life of love. When you begin to honestly say, today, Lord, I reprioritize my life. I change my life. Today, I, by my faith, follow you into a life of love. It is the only place and time in your life that you'll really find the poison begins to be taken away and the fruit will come. Simple story out of my own life. If I had a different life, I'd tell you that. But for me, it was this text and a mop in my hand and more urine across the floor from an old broken down nursing home. An old woman named Arizona in that bed. And these old people that had nobody else in their life. I got there under funny pretenses. I didn't go there for this reason, but I ended up going back day after day and week after week for the first time in my life to follow Christ. Actually meant less of me. And I'm going to go love somebody. And I was blown away that God kept his word to a knuckleheaded kid who had all the leafiness that a guy could stomach, but not much fruit. And it was with that mop and an old woman named Arizona that my story really started. I want to tell you that the Christian life as an addition to your life is worthless. You'll live in the same poison. You'll have leafy stuff all over you. But when you decide that Jesus Christ, your phrase, to follow you, I'm taking. That today I reorder my world. I reorder it. Today I get up. God, today, my wife, strengths or weaknesses, my husband's strengths or weaknesses, they're easy to love in some ways, hard to love in others, but today I will be your man or your woman in their life today. Today, Lord. Love is an action taken on behalf of the living God, on behalf of the people that he loves and cares for. Today, I love. When you have less of me and more of the love that is the leading, this is where the Spirit's taking you. When that occurs for the first time in your life, the Spirit says, here's the antidote you've always been looking for. This is the thing that pulls you back from being the crippled, scarred up individual you are to what you ought to be and what you want to be. It's a life of love. There's nothing wrong with it. Most of you in this room who struggle with this. There's nothing wrong with most of you in this room that simply deciding it is time to stop my own agenda and it is time to pick up the life of love that you would not find that bring out your dead
for the fruit of the Spirit becomes your experience. You see, I can't spiritualize the phrase walk by the Spirit, led by the Spirit, keep in step with the Spirit. I can't put my own definition to it. I can't say, okay, I decided to fast more so that I'd have more of the Spirit. I can't decide I decided to pray more so I'll have more of the Spirit. I can't decide I'm going to attend more church services so I'll have more of the Spirit. I can't put my own definition in and replace what is in this text. Being led by the Spirit, walking by the Spirit, in step with the Spirit, and pleasing the Spirit is today, Randy. Your wife, your kids, the people you work with, your neighbors, the poor. Did you love? If you love, I'll even clean out the attic and the basement of your life. The Spirit of God will do what you couldn't do. It is the anti-venom to the fruit you've had. But if you do not love, all the vegetation of a Christian life will produce nothing. Do you love? The life of a Christian becomes incredibly simple. It really does. You see, this world pulls me lots of ways with lots of interests, with lots of things. There's nothing wrong with lots of them in themselves, except they water down my singular agenda. And your life becomes a bunch of compartments where you just do all kinds of stuff and you try to slide a little and you get nothing. The life of the Christian, when he finally says, Jesus, you're right, come and die, and I want to pick up your agenda, that one, the poison goes away and the fruit comes. There is no negotiation on this. One of my favorite stories, I'm assuming some of you would sort of wink and say, well, Randy, as many times you've told it through the years, it's one of our favorites too now, but it's one of my favorite stories is the goose. And there's something in there that resonates for me. Prosperity Road is the little blacktop road that's just back east of us here, just a little ways. Runs between HH Highway over to Carterville and runs north-south. There were a set of guys on motorcycles coming down Prosperity Road. They were headed south, and as they were headed south, they came across a Canadian goose that was running down the road, just running down the road, this wild Canadian goose. And they got there, and they got off their motorcycles, and being guys, you know, and one of them, they caught the thing, and they could see where it had been wounded. Somebody had shot it, and the wing was clipped, and so it couldn't fly, and that's why it was running down the road, but it was running south down the road. So a guy took off his Levi jacket. He had some of the motorcycle stuff on it. I saw the picture in the Joplin Globe on the thing, and so he took the goose, and he wrapped the goose up inside of his Levi jacket, and the goose fought him all the way, and he wrapped it up, but he tied the goose between the handlebars of his motorcycle. We're in southwest Missouri. I don't let anything surprise you around here. That goose fought him every which way, but his motorcycle was parked west. He said the craziest thing was, he said, when I got it tied and I even turned the motorcycle south, that goose settled down. He said, I began to go south in the motorcycle. And I said, that goose just stuck its neck out. And he said, we went south down Prosperity. He said, I thought, oh, okay, the goose is kind of figuring this motorcycle thing out. And so he said, I'm going to take it to my house to figure out what to do next. So he turned west here on Newman Road, right here in front of the church. He turned west to come, and he said, about wrecked me. He said, that goose threw a fit. He said, I had to come to a stop, and when I stopped, I had the motorcycle turn south, and the goose settled down. He said, we began to play with it. And he said, he realized suddenly this goose had such a singular direction. He said, we went ahead and fought our way down to 20th Street. By the way, I mean, you know, he kind of weave around. He said, we got down to 20th Street. And he said, we finally have to come west to come into Joplin. So he said, we fought that goose all the way west. We got into Joplin. He said, I got to my house. I took a string and tied it to the leg of the goose, put a stake in the ground. And he said, that goose went to the south end of the string. He called the conservation agent. It's not legal to have one. Conservation agents are legal, but gooses are not. Every now and then I hear myself and go, eh. An education would have done me wonders. But anyhow, so he called the conservation agent. Conservation agent took it to the veterinarian. And veterinarian said, no, he said, we need a doctor, but he'll never fly again. It's past flying. So a couple weeks later, the vet's done with it, and they take the goose, the conservation agent calls, and said, we're going to turn it loose over Kellogg Lake over Carthage, because there's a bunch of geese that stay there, and he said it can live year-round at Kellogg Lake at Carthage. So they went over. Joplin Globe even went over. They went to the north side of the lake where the other geese were, and they turned that goose loose in the middle of that whole pile of geese. And this one goose just paddled right through the middle of them. And the last they saw, it was headed south across Kellogg Lake. It hit the shore and headed cross country, headed south. I somehow hear God whisper, Randy, if you had the brains, I gave a goose. You'd know the life I'm calling you to. Your direction would be clear. Randy, anything that you substitute, anything that you substitute for love, you're going to live with a poison in your life. And you're going to live without my fruit. When you decide to really love. I've lived long enough to know that there are seasons in my life. There are seasons that I do say, God, this is incredible. Your promises are true for a guy like me. I've also lived in seasons to know I feel like I'm a shadow. Not phony, but more hollow. Seasons where there didn't feel like there was substance. I think some of those seasons are a little natural. I think all of us are prone to a little discouragement or depression. I think that's part of the human condition. But the reality is, what's really going on is in the seasons where there is not wholeness, they are seasons where I learn to take a half a step back from everywhere that I should have been loving. I found a way to live in my with my wife, and she's happy and pleased, but there was too much Randy and not enough love for my wife. And my coworkers, I took a half step back, and it was too much Randy and not enough love for my coworkers. And I can work with people, and then I really do care, but I found a way to take a half a step back. And every time you ever withhold in a chapter of your life, I don't care because it's fear or anger or resentment or you think you're entitled, whenever you start taking and holding your life back from being a man or woman of God who really loves people, what you're going to get is the marijuana starts back in the corner of the attic again. There is a poison that inevitably comes if I do not walk with the Spirit, keep in step with the Spirit, please the Spirit. And in this text, he says it's love. And so I simply ask at the end of this, are you loving well? We have a strategy for you here at College Heights. We actually do have a battle plan. Our battle plan is not complex. It's the kindest thing we know to do for you. We know that just having this menagerie of Christian activities we do won't change lives. We know that. So we're not trying to throw to you a menagerie of things. What we're trying to do is help you with a three-step dance, a three-step waltz that involves three things. The three things all fit together to this one conclusion. We realize that no one will really be a disciple of Jesus Christ, which is what we're held accountable for as a church. Jesus turns to a church and he says to his church leaders, you make disciples. You make disciples. Not the charade kind of disciples, not the surface kind of disciples, not the shallow kind of disciples. You make passionate disciples of Jesus Christ who radically change the world, who advance the kingdom. That's what we're held accountable for. God will never applaud us because we were one of the larger churches in Joplin. He never will applaud us because of our numbers or our size. He will never applaud us except on the single issue, you made disciples. Well, how are you going to make disciples? Just throw the kitchen sink at them? No. No, you get a lot of leafiness, but you don't get a lot of fruit.
There's a three-step process that you're going to find throughout the New Testament. It's everywhere. It's also in Galatians 5. You're going to find it in 7, 8, and 9 of Galatians 5, 7, 8, 9, 10 of Galatians 5. But this three-step process for how you make disciples. Number one, no one ever becomes a real disciple of Jesus Christ. No one's ever even motivated to love. No one even knows how to love if you don't help them find the truth. And so you have to help people learn how to read their own Bibles for themselves. One of the most delightful things we do is help people sit down and just read their own Bible and go, wow, it came alive for me. I understand it. Man, we love to do that individually with people. Would be honored to do that with you. We want to do it in small groups where you're doing Bible studies. We're actually going to start in October. Do you know that we're taking the Bible and going to go through in 31 weeks? We're going to take you from Genesis to Revelation. Because we want you to see the story that is woven in through all of these chapters. We want you to know what God's doing. We want you to understand your own Bible. We want you to be people of the Word. Truth. Truth. If we ever wobble from truth, we can't help make disciples. Step one in the waltz or the dance. Step two in the waltz or the dance. We are community people. God made us in community. The defining marks of my life are almost always my friendships. We live in friendships. That's who we are. That's why when God is in the process of shaping us and molding us into His Son, He keeps saying things like, hang out with the wise and the godly and avoid the foolish and the wicked. Because it's in the rubbing of shoulders that you catch stuff. Stuff even intellectually, I didn't know how to process, but I caught it. And I understand it better. When we have a congregation like this and you begin to have three or four or five sets of friends and you just say to them, come to our house on Sunday nights and let's just pray together and let's have a meal together and let's talk and you laugh and you play cards. You tell stories on your kids. But you also turn and say, you know, this is the thing in my life that I really want to do better. Would you help me? And your friends pray for you and encourage you and you bear each other's burdens. And you love one another, and you're relationally centered. So we want truth. We want relationships. We want to be a congregation of small groups. We're not going to try to organize all your small groups. No, that's too mechanical. You, congratulations, tag, you're it. Go find three or four or five godly people. Go get as good of friends as you can afford. Somewhere that needs better wording, but you can figure out what I mean. Get godly friends that you hang out with. You do that and see what happens. Truth, relationships, and then last one, why service? Truth, relationships, and service. That's just the three-step waltz you just never stop doing. A dance. You sang songs about dance earlier? This is part of the dance. It's how I dance with in this kingdom. I serve. And you pick up the talon basin, and when you do, for the first time in your life, the poison begins to leave, and the fruit begins to come. It's the work of God.